Good morning. Please be seated.
In our third case today, 2022-0573, in the matter of Hanneman Family Funeral Home and Crematorium versus Patrick Orenz. On behalf of the appellant, Mr. Benzinger.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, if I could. May it please the court, opposing counsel, Your Honors. My name is Aaron Benzinger, and I represent the plaintiff in this case, Hanneman Family Funeral Homes, LLC. I'd like to go first into the issue of the trade secret violation. In this case, it dealt with the Ohio Uniform Trade Secret Act, which states that trade secret information cannot be used improperly. Improperly is defined 5 different ways in the law related to that statute, and it includes theft, bribery, misrepresentation, breach or inducement of a breach to maintain secrecy, or espionage. It is appellant's position that the primary claim with regard to our trade secret violation has to do with breach or inducement of a breach to maintain secrecy, which is one of the 5 ways you can have a trade secret violation. In this case, the defendant, Patrick Orenz, as well as a number of other funeral home employees during the depositions admitted that they all keep these records confidential, that they restrict access to these records from other employees, and that primarily the funeral director had access to these files for legitimate business purposes. Not only did they all agree that there's almost like a common law duty here, but in addition, they talked in their deposition about their ethical obligations under the Ohio Administrative Code, which also creates a duty to keep all confidences, privacies, confidential facts, confidential opinions, information about a person's life secret. So in this case, we had 2 different duties that Mr. Orenz was under. And when he went into the office after hours at night when no one else was there, went into the filing cabinet and turned a key to open it, that is when the breach of a duty to maintain secrecy began. It was when he went into those private, confidential, locked records with his own goals in mind rather than the goals of the business. That is when he breached the duty to maintain the secrecy of those documents. You'll hear discussion today about the fact that he only walked out the door with names and addresses. To be honest, we don't know for sure what he walked out the door with because he conveniently claims now that he decided to burn all the records later to get rid of them because of another agreement he had had with his previous employer. So we've never seen exactly what he took out of there. But what we do know is, luckily for us, a witness came by the night that one of the nights he was copying these records. And I'll state that the pre-need client files are in a specific type of folder, so you can tell them just by looking at the folder they're in. And this woman, Nancy Pajos, walked in and looked at him sitting at his desk with a pile of pre-need contract folders, which are rarely even touched by these funeral homes unless someone has passed away. And she said, "What are you doing?" And he admitted to her that he's taking the information so that he can get a job at another funeral home. And what's important here is the opposing party says that because these records were available to them through a public records request, that means that they can't qualify as a trade secret. And I have 2 responses to that. First, the files contained a dearth of information in addition to just names and addresses. It contained things like phone numbers, social security numbers, contract information, funeral wishes.
Okay, so I guess the question, though, is what evidence is that he used any of this other information besides the publicly available names and addresses?
Thank you, Your Honor. What we did is we went back and we looked at all the letters that he had sent out because that's...
And I say what evidence, but what evidence was there put in the record on the summary judgment motion? Because that's what we have to look at.
Correct. So in our summary judgment motion, we outlined and submitted evidence to the court that was attached to our brief where he referred to familial relationships in some of these letters, and there is no way that information was not part of the information he got from the public records. He would have had to have gleaned that information from the files as he was going through them. And when you look at that in the light most favorable to our party as the non-moving party, that's direct evidence of him using the arguably non-public part of the files to determine and reach out and solicit these people for his own business goals.
Is there anything else other than the family relationships?
So it's clear to us that, there is no specific evidence other than we know he left the office with a large amount of documents. What we do know is that he had the files open on his desk, so that would be my second piece of evidence, is he wasn't just opening a file, taking the top page, and copying it and putting it back. He was going through these files at his desk when he observed by the witness. And we think that's likely when he gleaned this additional information that he didn't necessarily need to take with him. Maybe he did, we don't know, but that we definitely know found was in these letters. And there was nearly 200 pre-need contract files in that office. It would have been impossible to memorize all these family relationships unless he had copied or written down additional information.
So you have kind of a theory that he copied down, but no evidence of that?
Well, so not really a theory. We know for a fact he took the names and addresses. But names and addresses, for two reasons, are not a public record in this case, even though they were obtained from the public records request. This court and state...
But wasn't really the question, right? So I mean, other than names and addresses, is there evidence of anything else?
Yes, that he took familial relationships and used those relationships in letters to glean, to make it appear that he was writing a personal letter and he knew their file.
He took familial relationships, for example.
For example, in one of his letters, I can't remember the name, we'll say Jane. He wrote a letter to Jane and said, "Your parents have pre-need contract files at my office. Please contact me, and I'd like to explain about a new opportunity with regard to those files." And then he sent that letter out. That would not have been in anything he got from the public records, and it would not have been in anything that he would have obtained from any other place other than the file that listed this daughter as the, in this case, it was a daughter. And so he contacted her.
Okay, and where do I find that if I want to go back and look at that in your summary judgment materials?
It's in this section with regard to trade secret violations, and we actually attached that letter. I think it's Exhibit B to our motion.
So it's just one letter, or?
The one we put in as evidence was one letter. In addition.
But did you document that there were 200?
We did document that there was 200 total files. It's important to know that he took 99 of those files. Of those 99 files, he had to use some criteria to determine who he was going to reach out to and who he was going to contact.
So how many letters listed a family relationship?
I want to say that there's at least three or four. And that was talked about in the deposition testimony that was submitted to the court.
And that's in the record as well?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
I would submit that this court in State X. Rel. Bessler versus Ohio State University specifically stated that just because a record can be obtained through a public records request, that does not mean that that information is not trade secret anymore. It says, trade secrets that are created or come into the possession of an Ohio public office and would render the remedies in the Trade Secret Act meaningless when a request for these records is made. The Public Record Act is simply an improper means to acquire knowledge of a trade secret. So I would submit that even though he obtained these records through a public records request, this court has already ruled that because of the amount of reporting businesses have to do, that doesn't mean that everything that they submit is no longer afforded trade secret protection.
So wait a second. So that would mean that if someone else asked for those records, got them legitimately through a public records request and used them, that they were violating the Trade Secrets Act?
So I would argue that yes, if they used, not if that's all they did was send in a public records request, but in this case, what he did first was go into the filing cabinet, look through the files, and send out letters. It was after the fact when we were in litigation that he filed the public records request.
Okay, but I think I heard you say generally that you believe the fact that something's a public record doesn't mean that it's not a trade secret violation to use that. So if a third party asks for these things and then uses them, are they violating the Trade Secrets Act, in your view?
I would say yes, if they first went to the database that is maintained by the business in secrecy, but if all they did was file a trade secrets act and send out letters, that would not be a trade secret violation because they're simply using the information they obtained from the public record. However, it's not a defense to a Trade Secret Act violation, according to Bessler, because if the only place they were able to get these records publicly was through that public records request they sent in, and additionally, as of September 2021, you can't even get the records through a public records request. The legislature saw, and I think this goes to the intent of the legislature at the time they instituted the Trade Secret Act. They wanted to make sure that when something rises to the level of trade secret, that it's protected. So I'd like to move on to the third issue referenced in my brief that has to do with the abrogation. When something is a trade secret, the question is, can you then also sue for conversion or intentional interference with business relationship? The appellee in this case would argue that even if it's not a trade secret, if it's a claim stylized like a trade secret, then it would obviate the rest of those causes of action. However, though this court has never specifically addressed it, the Supreme Courts of Arizona and Wisconsin, which I understand are very little persuasive in this court, but they did deal with the specific issue, and they found that the purpose of the Trade Secret Act was not to get rid of the rest of these causes of action. And I would say in Ohio, our reason for that is the Trade Secret Act is a highly punitive and severe claim to allege against someone. It involves attorney fees. It involves certain other damages that can only be obtained in a Trade Secret Act violation. What means is that even if it doesn't rise to the level of the trade secret, a party should still have an opportunity if their property has been converted or there's been an interference with the business relationship. And in line with Arizona and Wisconsin, I would ask that this court could find along the same lines. Can I ask a question? Is this already count? Is this down from 15, or does this mean I still have
15. You still have 3 minutes, 33
okay.
seconds.
I will reserve the rest for rebuttal if that's okay.
Absolutely. Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Smith.
Good morning, Your Honor. If I can, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Chief Justice Kennedy, Associate Justices of the Court, Dalton Smith on behalf of Appellees, Cross Appellants, Patrick Oriens, and Charles Lehman Funeral Home. I would actually like to begin by addressing one of the questions raised by Justice DeWine, the question of what evidence is there in the record of appellants' pre-need files, that information. I would specify to the court, the only thing that's in the record regarding pre-needs, the actual files, are pre-need funeral contracts. Those were filed as Defendant's Exhibit C under seal because those do contain Social Security numbers. The files themselves, which appellants have now made reference to, are nowhere in the record. They at no point were admitted. They were not attached to a motion for summary judgment. They were not used in a deposition. There has been some testimony as to information that was accessed by Appellee Patrick Oriens, but that's the totality of the evidence that has been presented as to what might have been found in those files. For argument today, I would like to begin by advising this court that it has all of the tools it needs to decide this case correctly in front of it. And the tools to which I am making reference are specifically this court's precedent in the domain of trade secret litigation. I would specifically refer to this court's decisions in State X Rel Plain Dealer, State X Rel Lucas County Board of Commissioners, State X Rel Rea, and State X Rel Cincinnati Enquirer, and State X Rel Besser. All of these cases have been situations in which this court has considered what factors and elements and evidence is required for a party to prove that it has a protectable trade secret under the Ohio Uniform Trade Secret Act. And referring to State X Rel Plain Dealer, this court has stated, a document is entitled to trade secret status only if the information is not generally known or readily ascertainable. And specifically discussing client lists in State X Rel Lucas County Board of Commissioners, this court has stated, where the identity of customers is readily ascertainable through ordinary business channels or through classified business or trade directories, The courts refused to accord to the list the protection of a trade secret.
So how is their alleged protected trade secrets outside of, how do they fall into the category of Lucas County or Plain Dealer or Cincy Enquirer?
Thank you, Your Honor. It would be Appley's position that they do not fall into the category of a trade secret, specifically for, and it's fairly obvious on its face, in order to have a trade secret, it must be a secret. It is just common sense.
Well, but how is the information that your client received from them, how is it readily ascertainable? I mean, of course, you can get addresses, phone numbers of people in general, but these are specific people, clients that are specific to this company. So how else would he have obtained the information if not through the confidential files?
Right. It would be Appley's position that exact same information that he would have been necessary for him to contact these individuals could have been obtained at any time via a public records request to the Ohio Board of Embalmers and Funeral Directors. Specifically, on August 1st of 2019, Hanneman Family Funeral Homes, through Craig Hanneman, its proprietor, purchased what he characterized in his deposition as a cluster of funeral homes, four funeral homes. As part of his application for a transfer of the license of those four funeral homes, he was required, pursuant to RC 4717.13C, to submit a complete enumerated report of every pre-need funeral contract located at each of those four funeral homes. Both parties, appellants and appellees, submitted public records requests to the Ohio Board of Embalmers specifically asking for that report, pursuant to 4717.13C.
And so did they obtain those records?
Yes. Both parties obtained those records. What was produced by appellant was only those records from the Lindsay Foose Cocker Funeral Home. Appellees obtained a complete set of enumerated pre-need contracts
for all four,
including Seifert Orions and three others.
And obviously, so it's information that your client is alleged to have misappropriated from Hanneman. Anything different in addition to what was received in the public records requests?
Appellant's position throughout this litigation has changed as to the nature of what his trade secret was. It had begun specifically as the types of information that were obtained by Appley through a public records request. I'm holding before you today Defendant Exhibit HH, which is also attached to Defendant Exhibit Y, which was an affidavit about that public records request and those results. And what Appley obtained was a complete enumerated list of 238 pre-need funeral contract policies that included the name, the age of the party that had obtained the policy, the issuing date of that policy, which then also would naturally indicate what the age of that party was at the time that they had obtained that for identification purposes, and the death benefit. And the death benefit is very significant because appellant's allegations have essentially morphed into Appley Patrick Orients must have gone through these files because he cherry-picked and chose the most lucrative contracts. Appley would disagree with that characterization, but it's not necessary. Multiple funeral directors as part of this lawsuit were deposed, and they testified as to the creation and how the value of a pre-need funeral contract policy is reached. Funeral homes are required to keep public lists of the services that they offer and the cost of the material that they offer. Those are accessible to the public. When they write a pre-need funeral policy and sell it to fund a pre-need funeral contract, it has to be written down to the dollar. So the death benefit of those life insurance policies that fund those pre-need funeral contracts is the value of the contract. And I would specifically refer the court to the deposition testimony of Gary Kill, who is a funeral director for Childs Lehman, who testified that at most the most variance you can find in a pre-need funeral contract is the provision of a lunch after the funeral. Maybe that can be removed, but beyond that, everything is down to the dollar. So in Defendant's Exhibit HH, which is a public record and has been obtained, that death benefit corresponds to the value of all those pre-needs. And in going through Defendant's Exhibit HH, that directly defeats the allegations from appellants that Appley Orient somehow went through and cherry-picked the most valuable files. And I'm just going to point to two examples so the court can have them. First, I would point to James D. Bassett. So Mr. Bassett is one of 56 pre-need clients who transferred to Childs Lehman. Mr. Bassett was also essentially a custodian for the Seifert Orient Funeral Home and lived on site. After Hanneman acquired that funeral home, he was terminated and required to move, and he transferred his pre-need to Childs Lehman. He was contacted by Appley Orients. The value of his pre-need policy is $653. And going through Defendant's Exhibit HH, you will see that there are policies in excess of $16,000. That is among one of the lowest value pre-need policies that exists. I think there is one that's $500 and one that's $73. But
well, what about the allegation that the only way they could have received information about a family relationship as they're sending out those letters to try to get that family to come with their pre-need contract to the other funeral home? What about that? Is that in the public record?
I would say it is in the public record. I would also note that...
Tell me where.
Well, I don't know that family relation is confidential. I mean, a basic Westlaw search that I regularly do will reveal relatives.
So it's not in whatever information goes into this public registry, that information's not there?
Specifically in referring to Defendant's Exhibit HH, no, it is not contained in that document.
Okay.
What I would point out is that prior to his termination, Appley Orient served this community, the Lima, Ohio community, for 33 years. And also, the specific letter that appellant has referred to was not a solicitation letter. I would break the letters down into two categories. I would say there were solicitation letters and there were confirmation letters. The letter that he is referring to, which is also attached to our motion for summary judgment, I believe it's within Defense Exhibit K, I believe, was to the daughter of Stephanie Mansfield. I'm sorry, to Stephanie Mansfield, Martha M. Mansfield was her mother, who had a pre-need worth $772. That was not a solicitation letter. If the court goes to that letter, it will specifically find its confirmation. Mr. Orient communicates to her that he appreciates their call and for reaching out to him, and that he's basically honored that they want to go with him. The entirety of the letters that he sent out had been provided in litigation. The only letter to the Mansfield was a confirmation letter, indicating there was a face-to-face meeting, and also indicating that Mr. Orient was probably familiar with the family. I think the letter even acknowledges that the family had requested he provide releases for two other individuals that they knew. I'm seeing I've reached 5 minutes, so I would like to get to preemption argument. Obviously, it would be Appley's position that appellants don't have a protectable trade secret, and the remaining claims being tortious interference with a contract and tortious interference with a prospective business relationship and conversion are causes of actions that are preempted under 1333.67A. And while this court has not spoken to whether Ohio is a majority jurisdiction or minority jurisdiction as far as uniform trade secret. Sorry, I need a sip of water here. Uniform trade secret law. In State XRL Besser, this court did reemphasize that the purpose behind the Ohio Uniform Trade Secret Act is to ensure uniformity in the application of trade secret law throughout the states that have adopted the Ohio Uniform Trade Secret Act. Appellees point to two state Supreme Courts. One is Arizona. Arizona has followed the minority approach. However, its decision, frankly, is somewhat baffling. It just says uniformity is a fruitless endeavor, and then it also notes that meaningfully their statutory scheme is different than ours, and that there is not a statutory provision that requires interpretation in uniformity with the Ohio Uniform Trade Secret Act. The only other minority Supreme Court decision comes out of Wisconsin, and it finds there's possibly a cause of action for just confidential information. However, the court doesn't go on to expound what that claim would look like.
Well, I mean, isn't our tortious interference cause of action, isn't that broader than the definition of trade secrets?
I would say it.
In the confidential business information thing you raised, for example.
Right. Thank you, Your Honor. I would make a couple points to that. The first thing to be considered is the nature of the claims alleged. So, the tortious interference with a contract, tortious interference with a prospective business relationship, as pled by the appellants, is a mere recitation of the trade secret claim, conversion of confidential trade secret information. In order for it to be a trade secret, it necessarily must maintain some secrecy and derive some value from not generally being known. Obviously, it would be an appellee's position. It is generally known. But in the situation where it's not a trade secret, it is either a secret without some inherent value, or it's information that does have value but is generally available, can be obtained by anybody. The claims for tortious interference with a business relationship, business contract, could encapsulate types of behavior that didn't stem from the misappropriation of that type of information. Conceivably, there's some type of other wrongful behavior a party could do other than misappropriate alleged trade secrets. But the appellant's claims, as they rest before this court, are solely for the misappropriation of that information. And I would also...
You could misappropriate information that wasn't a trade secret, right? I mean, wrongfully, you could wiretap someone's phone or whatever and use that to interfere with a business relationship. That would, I think, be tortious interference, even though the information might not be a trade secret, might not rise to the level.
Right. There would have to be something wrongful about the nature of the knowledge used. I suppose in that situation, it would be an invasion of privacy if it was a private phone call and that was the information that had been utilized. As appellant's claims rest, it is only for the exact same information that they allege constitutes a trade secret. And I would just also make the point of, under RC 471732, pre-need funeral contracts are required to be in writing. They must be in writing in order to be enforceable. And as to prospective business relationship, appellants have utterly failed to point to anyone who may have been a client of Hanneman Seifert Funeral Home, who then went to Childs Lehman Funeral Home. The only allegations revolve around transferred, executed, pre-existing, pre-need funeral contracts that followed Appley Orion's over to Childs Lehman. But also, I would just refer the court to the New Hampshire Supreme Court's decision in Mortgage Specialties Incorporated v. Davey, and I think that their application that under these uniform trade secret codes, information is classified as either protected trade secret or unprotected general knowledge. And so it's left with a decision. Either it's a trade secret or it's general knowledge, and the use of that information then cannot be wrongful. Thank you.
Thank you. You still have 3 minutes, 29 seconds, Mr. Benson.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I'd like to point out that the opposing counsel cited to the Besser case 3 times, and that's the exact case that says you cannot avoid a trade secret violation act if you obtain those records through a public records request. It's in the same case that he's relying on. In addition, the difference between us and some of these client list cases is that our information contained a lot more than just a client list, as we talked about. Even just to get the first page, he would have had to look at the rest of it and open it up. However, the trial court found that we could move forward with our conversion and our intentional interference with business relationship claims, except for they found that damages were speculative. First of all, I'd like to say there's 2 types of damages in this case. At the time we wrote the response to the motion for summary judgment, one person had already died. Those damages were concrete and ascertained. We would have known that 100% for sure. So for that reason alone, we would argue that the damages are not speculative. But with the other types of damages for those that will happen in the future, there's cases that explain exactly how someone shows with significant reliability what future damages will be. And in this case, this was not a new business that just opened its doors. It was a business who bought a 30-year business, who basically, they came in and changed management, but it's the same building, it's the same services, you know, everything else was the same. So this was a business that had a past performance record, a track record. You know, that's what what my client relied on when he decided to buy it, is he looked for high performing, and he also looked at, as he testified in his deposition, he looked at the pre-need contracts as one of the specific things he considered being a valuable asset of the company.
But if we were to look at or entertain the tortious interference claims, you're only providing us with one case where we know that the damages aren't speculative. Is it premature for us to be looking at those issues?
Well, it absolutely was premature. I'd like to say that this Supreme Court in Ohio has held that a party should be given an opportunity to defend a motion for summary judgment. The Rule 54 specifically says that the court can only rule on those issues that have been raised and fully briefed by the parties. Then this court went on to say that if there's no full briefing of an issue, that the court shouldn't rule on that issue. However, the court in this case ruled sua sponte on its own motion, which absolutely can happen. However, this Supreme Court stated in Hook v. Ross, that, which is a case cited by the appellate court in its finding, that an entry of summary judgment against a party that isn't moving in any way, that it would not afford him due process rights if all the facts and material to the issue being litigated is not before the court. In this case, we never raised damages at any point in time in the briefing. We never submitted any evidence. We had disclosed two experts that were going to testify about valuing the policies. We do know that some of these people had passed away, so those are concrete and certain. And so because of that, we would at least have made an argument at the summary judgment stage if we had been given a chance. I would have had my experts submit full affidavits. It was just never raised by anyone. And this court held that when it comes to summary judgment, which is a totally different standard, a party should have an opportunity to at least bring evidence before the court to consider. And we never had that opportunity in this case. So for that reason alone, I would ask that we get an opportunity to at least submit evidence on the damages issue to show that there's concrete damages and it's not. I'm sorry, I ran out of time. I appreciate your time, Your Honors.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll receive a decision from the court.